Welcome back to the program. It's long been observed that the four scariest words a husband can hear are, "We need to talk." The only thing that might be scarier is we need to talk about our marriage and ways to make it better. Yet with that as the basis, our guest, Elizabeth Weil, began a quest that would take her into the heart of darkness of her marriage. But unlike Kurtz, she and her husband would both return and perhaps be better off for the journey. Elizabeth Weil is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine, and it is my pleasure to welcome her back to this program to talk about No Cheating, No Dying, I Had a Good Marriage, Then I Tried to Make It Better. Elizabeth Weil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I love how your husband's initial reaction to this idea was, "That's the worst idea I ever heard."
I know. You know, I think it's a really typical reaction, you know, from his perspective, you know, he was being like, "We have a great marriage," or as he likes to call it, "We have a perfectly decent marriage. Why do you want to go, you know, stirring the pot?"
To what extent, from an intellectual point of view, did you think, you know, maybe that's right. Maybe if it's not broken, why are we trying to fix it?
Well, it is a really compelling idea, and marriage is really scary to change, and that it's so emotional, it's so central to our lives. But, you know, the "if it's not broke, don't fix it" wasn't the approach I was taking to almost anything else. You know, it wasn't the approach I was taking to my professional life. It wasn't the approach I was taking to raising my children. It wasn't the approach I was taking to my health or to being a friend. And then once I started down that road, once I started, you know, reading books about marriage, it was incredible. You know, a lot of people have thought a lot about love and relationships, and they know a lot of things that I didn't know.
But, of course, one of the things people have said, as you talk about, is that marriages are this sort of delicate balance between two people, and that sometimes when you start messing with the primal forces of that balance, things could go awry.
Yes. And, you know, I wouldn't have done this if I thought my marriage was really precarious, or, you know, I would have sought help, but I don't know if I would have explored it as exhaustively, or certainly the process would have been different. And certainly, you know, we had moments that were harder during the time we spent actively working on our marriage than we would have had we done nothing. But we're in a much better place for it. It really turned out to be terrific.
One of the observations is that most people wait until things are sort of hopelessly bad, way past the time to try and fix them before they do anything.
Yes, and that makes it so much harder to fix. You know, to use the physical health analogy, it's the same there. You know, you wait until your health really deteriorates to try to take care of yourself, and you're in a big hole. You know, you have weight to lose or whatever it is. It becomes very difficult to get back to health. And I think the same is true in our emotional lives and with our marriage, that don't wait until things are running off the rails to try to, you know, make it the best you can be and take care of yourself. If you're proactive, it's really not so difficult.
How did you get your husband, Dan, to buy into this idea?
You know, he was, you know, as you mentioned, resistant at first, but he didn't put up much of a fight. For one thing, he's an incredibly good sport, and he also cared deeply about our marriage. And once we started in, it was fascinating and thrilling and scary and compelling. So after we started, he didn't continue resisting.
Talk about the extent to which in all of the things that you started to read and all of the research that you were doing that preceded this project, the degree to which there was conflicting information about what constituted a good marriage.
Oh, wow. There's endlessly conflicting information about what's a good marriage. Just in the same way as that there's endlessly conflicting information about what makes a good mother. And for so many reasons, you know, the institution of marriage has changed a lot over time and is continuing to change. And what people considered to be a good marriage a generation or two or three ago is very different from what a lot of my peers, I'm in my early 40s, and people who are younger than I am are looking for today. You know, so, and there are people who put a tremendous amount of stock and passion and romance, and then there are other people who have put a tremendous amount of stock in security and stability. And those things can be at odds. You know, you can't have everything.
Were you surprised? This project started out before there was the book. There was a lengthy article that you wrote that appeared in the New York Times Magazine back in 2009 that really garnered a tremendous reaction.
Yes, I was completely taken aback. And it was fascinating to see how provocative it was for people. Because, you know, as a writer, you're sitting very quietly in your office with your computer, and people aren't reacting. You're reacting to your prose, and that's it. And that piece came out, and the reaction was just explosive. People loved it. People hated it. People thought what we were doing was fantastic. They thought what we were doing was horrible. And in some ways, I feel like it was a little bit of a Rorschach test about, for, you know, people's own reactions reflected things in their own lives.
What did it tell you in that regard? To what extent did you see patterns, sort of, in terms of how people reacted?
Well, what it told me, first of all, is that people are sort of in desperate need of honest, intimate stories about marriage, that marriage is so private, and it's so hard to know if what's going on in your own home is typical, if it's representative, you know, any of those things. And so to have a story out there, and our marriage is not unusual, that was just, this is what it's like for us, that people really gravitated towards it and reacted to it. And then, you know, what did it tell me about people's reactions? You know, a little all over the map. I mean, there were certainly people who felt like a woman shouldn't do this, and that there were sort of gendered reactions to it. A man would never tell such a story. So, you know, I feel like those were reflections about what people thought about gender roles, or there were certainly other reactions that I would see in people that the article really provoked them in some way. And it made me wonder a little bit, well, you know, what's going on in your life that this is so provocative for you?
And the interesting thing is, in some sense, it does seem that our culture is so pervasive with stories about sex and romance and relationships. And yet, as you say, in some ways it is, in some ways it isn't.
Yeah, so there are these, stylized and partial looks at relationships. Sure, there's images of sex everywhere, and there are images of fabulous romance everywhere. But there aren't complex, complicated pictures of marriage everywhere. In some ways, it's not the fantasy. And so much of what's produced, you know, in movies and books is the fantasy. We want to read fantasies.
And to what extent do those fantasies become the ideal that people either strive for or afraid they're falling short of? And what's the negative implication of that?
Well, I think to a great extent, you know, marriages start with some kind of fantasy, and it's not just produced by Hollywood. It's also, you know, in our hearts, we all start in this beautiful, romantic place, you know, with this vision of this perfect day. And that can be difficult, you know, when a year or two or 10 or 20 later, that you're no longer living in that fantasy. And hard things happen in all of our lives. And if you're not expecting them to happen, they can feel worse.
I mean, as you say early on in the book, that you didn't really want a new marriage. You just wanted a sort of photoshopped version of your current one.
Well, that's what I thought better would be. I had a sort of simplistic view about better at the very beginning, that better would mean all the things that annoyed me would be gone. You know, Dan wouldn't leave his socks around the house, you know, and we wouldn't bicker about how to spend our weekends. And then those things, as we, you know, we got further and deeper into looking at our marriage, became somewhat small time for me, that they weren't the things that mattered. And I didn't want some perfect idealized and in some ways, you know, generalized vision of marriage. I wanted my marriage in particular, and my marriage in particular was going to include socks around the house. And I decided that that was okay.
Were you concerned at any point that as you started tinkering with it, as you started knocking the barnacles off the bottom of the boat, that it would start to leak, that it would upset that delicate balance?
You know, we certainly had some dark days. I never got to the point of actually feeling like the boat was going to sink. But change is really scary, as I said before, and change in marriage is especially scary as you're two people, and what you want and what your partner wants might not be the same. So we didn't get to, oh my God, the boat is actually sinking, but there were some rough patches.
There was some taking on of water along the way.
We took on a little water, yeah.
The other part of it is in trying to compare marriages and sort of compare one to the other, even beyond the romanticized, book and television notions, that everyone is kind of like a fingerprint, that everyone is different, and that it's a function of time and place and the individuals and the time in their lives when they get married. I mean, there's so many moving parts, so to speak.
Yes, and your values. What is right for me in my marriage is not what's right for you or anybody else necessarily. But we really got a long way towards a better understanding of what is right for us. What is the life that we want to live? And I think that's really important to really get clear on what is right for us.
And how did you get to that? Talk a little bit about the process that you went through.
All right. Well, we did a lot. So I started off, like I said, reading. I'm a writer, so books are a natural place for me to gravitate to. So first of all, I just started reading books like one of my favorites, Can Love Last? The Fate of Romance Over Time. It's written by a psychoanalyst. And then I started reading self-help books. And then we started going to some marriage education classes. And then we tried lots of different kinds of therapy. And we met with clergy. And we thought about how we were dealing with money. And we just decided to, look in all the corners. And it was fascinating. We also decided to swim from Alcatraz back to San Francisco. And there's a lot of research that doing sort of thrilling, novel things together can be great for couples. And that was fantastic. It really sort of provoked all those exhilarating feelings of falling in love that we're all trying to get back to all the time.
And you even looked at some of the more cynical approaches. I mean, you talk about, Michael Vincent Miller and his ideas about
that. Yes, Michael Vincent Miller wrote a very dark book called Intimate Terrorism, and he uses some analogies in it that in marriage we are really competing against each other for limited resources. And that was one of those ideas that was really instructive to read and think about, well, in what ways are we competing against each other? But it wasn't the kind of book that you wanted to, curl up with in bed at night.
But it does talk about and sort of imply a certain degree of energy in that marriage is a kind of protracted conflict that goes on.
Right. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, you are spending your lives in some sense negotiating with each other.
Right.
And negotiating with each other over things large and small. What are we going to do with our Saturday? How are we going to spend our money? What's important to us, and it is true. And in some ways, I think the reason the Alcatraz swimmer doing something like that was so exhilarating is it takes you out of the conflict with each other, a sort of man versus man plot, or man versus woman in this case plot, and puts you in a man versus nature plot, where you have a common enemy or you have a common challenge, and that can feel fantastic.
Right. The common enemy, or more specifically what happens is, and you talk a little bit about this, the common crisis that comes along often has an interesting impact.
Yes, and crises, life is hard. Every marriage hits a crisis, whether it's illness or death or, a financial crisis. And those are really difficult, and we all deal with crises in our own ways, and it can often be really hard to support your spouse when you're really hurting too. So that was really important to think about and to understand and to try to be prepared for.
You also talk about that you learned a lot by reading how other people dealt with the death of a spouse in some cases.
Yes, that was fascinating. It was sort of funny when I was working on sort of that part of the book and that part of our lives, and I was joking with my friends that I was on the marriage and death chapter, and it seemed so dark and depressing. And in some ways it turned out to be the most beautiful part of the whole experience, because when you read books by people who have been widowed, they love everything about the partner that they've lost. And they love the things that had driven them crazy. They love the things that sort of had resisted conforming to what the other person wanted, you know. So there's a wonderful book by Calvin Trillin called About Alice, about his wife. And he writes about just loving, you know, everything about her, loving that, you know, she spent tons of money on shoes, things that he had, I'm sure, not loved in that moment. But they were deeply her. They were truly her. They weren't him. And so it was really wonderful to read that and think about that before you're in the position of having lost somebody.
Right. Also, but on the other hand, interesting to think about marriage in the context of, you know, oh, it's easier when one of the spouses is dead.
Right. Well, of course, because, yes, you're not confronted with that situation, you know, like, oh, honey, why did you spend $500 on shoes? You know, yes, so it was funny also that you read these books and, like, once someone dies, it's all easy.
To what extent did you start to see, during the process, changes in sort of the terms of your marriage?
Well, first we more saw changes in the way we would communicate. You know, like every couple, we had our fights that were just looping around in circles, you know, our standard fights that didn't really get anywhere. And so the first thing that happened is that we stopped having looping fights. We started actually breaking through them and not doing that anymore. So most of the big changes, I feel like, were subtle in that way. You know, we didn't make large changes, but we made changes in how empathetic we were to one another, how good we were at understanding each other and how much effort we put into that.
To what extent did some of that empathy come from the fact of realizing, as you went to all of these seminars and read all of this and everything else, that this is hard to do? And there was some appreciation that evolved about how difficult it was.
Well, it was very humbling. You know, I'm a writer and my husband is also a writer. So one of the early seminars we went to was a marriage education class. And these classes spend a lot of time teaching communication skills. And I felt, and Dan did too, we don't need communication skills. We are professional communications people. We do not need this. And it was so humbling to be there and to learn so much so quickly and realize it didn't matter if you had a big vocabulary or a small vocabulary or if you could write a pretty sentence, that what mattered was how well, you know, you were empathizing with and communicating with your partner, and that is it.
And was that a continuation of negotiation?
What do you mean?
In other words, did all of these steps along the way kind of contribute to the need for more negotiation?
That
it
well,
was, you know, I mean,
yes.
The way diplomacy is often defined as, you know, war by different means.
I mean, well, certainly, you know, we had sort of like thrown everything up in the air and we were going to, in some sense, have to renegotiate where all the pieces were going to fall back into place. So in that sense, yes, it prompted a tremendous amount of negotiation. But I think we did a much better job in that so many pieces of marriage sort of fall into place in a sort of haphazard way as you're forming your relationship and falling in love. And that's a very particular circumstance. And maybe you do a good job and maybe you don't do a good job. And maybe it makes sense for the long term and maybe it doesn't. But as so many things, you know, we get in habits and this is how we do things. So it was really valuable to, you know, 10 and 12 years in, say, well, how do we really want to do things? And does it make sense, you know, some of the habits we've formed together?
And as you talk about some of the foundational things that happen early on, kind of set the stage that's very hard to change later.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of writing about this, too, that mm-hmm. that the origins of our relationships and our marriages make a tremendous impact. And that was really true for us, too, in ways that we didn't really see. You know, Dan and I met the week he had broken off another relationship, and he was hurting. And that's but we also fell in love, and that's the moment we started. And it was unnerving to realize how much the timing of that was still impacting our marriage a decade mm-hmm. later.
Yeah. It's always interesting how kids want to know how their parents met, and it's sort of a reminder of how important in some ways that origin story really is.
Yes, origin stories are incredibly important, and of course we can all tell our own origin stories to ourselves and to our children in many different ways. You know, so the origin story I tell my children, they're still quite young, you know, it's somewhat different from the one I would tell a friend
mm-hmm.
or even necessarily tell myself. I tell myself a more complicated story than I would tell them, at least right now.
And, of course, over long periods of time, those stories become enhanced or somewhat apocryphal.
Yes.
And that contributes to the relationship as well, sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Yes, so, you know, stories take on a life of their own, absolutely.
Elizabeth Weil, her book is No Cheating, No Dying, I Had a Good Marriage, and Then I Tried to Make it Better. Elizabeth, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.